Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now it's time for the Friday gathering. This week I'm joined by Fine Gael TD for Dublin Bay South, James Gagan, Labour TD for Wexford, spokesperson on enterprise, tourism and employment, George Lawler, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror, Louise Byrne, and journalist and commentator, Brenda Power. We might start with the news we heard. I don't know if you heard that earlier on the programme. We had Olaf Gill on, European Commission spokesperson on trade. So Maroš Šefčovič is on his way to the White House. He'll be there on Sunday. And it seems very clear now that Ursula von der Leyen is going to say big tech is on the table here. Brenda, why are you wincing?
Well, obviously, that is a concern for us. And there's no doubt that the EU has had their sights set on our big tech boom for years.
But
so I don't think there'd be much sympathy for us.
From what he said, they're hoping it's not going to come to that. Well, I mean, that's the threat. That's the big bazooka, isn't it?
But sure, nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, that is it. We're just not dealing with serious people. I mean, what's happening with China? I think I heard on the news coming in that China are saying this is getting close to a joke. You know, this is playground stuff. You put 125% tariff on my goods, I go 145 on yours. I mean, I think there is a sense that all reason has been lost. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to know what exactly
it's playground stuff, but it's so serious. It's so serious. Impactful,
I mean,
you know?
I think one of the things that might have given Trump pause, although he's trying to spin it, of course, as what was his plan all along, was people like Bill Ackerman, that hedge fund billionaire, saying you are laying the groundwork for a nuclear winter. In other words, that generations will be paying the price for the harm that you are doing at the moment.
Yeah, I was reminding Olaf Gill that this would have serious consequences, James, for us, you know, if this were to happen, if they were to tax the profits of big tech headquartered here in Ireland. He said, we're well aware of that. So obviously we're lobbying, but are they listening? Is the EU listening to us?
Well, I think, you know, good man from Mayo, he would be well aware of what's going on in Ireland, which I think is helpful that we have these senior people at an Irish European Commission level. But I mean, I did listen to that interview, and what Olaf Gill did make clear to you was that, you know, we're talking about a de-escalation, not an escalation. I think what was on the front of the Financial Times today was really just a reiteration of what the European Union position is that, yes, there are these, I suppose, extreme measures, some people call them the nuclear measures, that are tools at the EU's disposal to use. But right now, we are in a better space than we were a couple of days ago, notwithstanding the extraordinary uncertainty, volatility, and all of the impact that is having on investment. But we are in a situation now where negotiations are commencing. So like you said there, the commissioner himself is going out to the United States. Obviously, from our own perspective, the Taoiseach to Simon Harris was just in Washington, D.C. Minister Martin Hayden for Agriculture is continuing his trade mission in the United States. And both were in regular contact with the EU negotiators throughout their engagements in the United States. So there's a process at least.
But we have to take this threat to big tech very, very seriously. Like, it's on the front page of the Financial Times, and it was put there for a reason, you know?
Well, I think the EU has to have at its disposal, it has to have the tools available to it so that they are, when they're negotiating with the United States, they look in the whites of the eyes of the negotiators on the other side, that they are willing to take every measure necessary to protect the interests of the 460 million citizens that live in Europe.
Then they're clearly playing chicken with our future and our economy.
Well, the Irish government has made extremely clear, and Taoiseach Simon Harris has been clear on this, before Donald Trump issued the pause that has now been issued, that there wasn't a majority within the European Union countries in favour of using these extreme measures in terms of responding to what has taken place. And that will be a consistent position that Ireland will hold. Mm-hmm. But we have to be truthful here. You know, we do have to ensure that the EU has all of the strength it can have in these negotiations. And we are much better. We will be absolutely.
Yeah, we're saying to them, you can go and threaten that, but please, George Lord, if you would, please, we're saying, don't go there, don't use it, right?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of negotiations, it's terrific. I think that Maroš Šefčovič has gone to head negotiations with the US, but we also need strong negotiations with our own, being the EU, and you know, Ursula von der Leyen doesn't have a great track record when it comes to Irish issues. We've seen her in the past where she has gone out on a limb.
Were they not completely supportive of us on the Brexit issue?
They were supportive, but in area in other areas she has had difficulties, and we have called her out a couple of times on issues. So I think the big tech issue will be crucial for us. It's a game changer. If this is placed on the table tariffs. I think we are.
But
it's
clear that the EU doesn't want to go there. I mean, Olaf Gill said what they'll be offering initially is zero for zero. I mean, we know Donald Trump has refused that, but then things have changed a lot since he refused because he put the pause in place.
I mean, we're dealing with a dysfunctional administration. In reality, you know, this is not a normal government to government or continent to continent even negotiation. This is the world negotiating with, as Brenda said, you know, school ground activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 90-day. hiatus, if you like, or lacuna. Whilst it seems a long time, it's nothing in trade terms, but it's a world in Donald Trump terms. Hour by hour,
depending
what the things can change. The bond market has been the absolute game changer. That is the one that brought others to Donald Trump to bring him to the table.
Yeah, and you had experience of that in the past because you were working for Brendan Howland, weren't you, in 2008?
Well,
when we saw this happening.
Well, it was essentially the bond market, the Irish bonds that decided that we needed to bring the IMF in to control our economy. Mm-hmm. When the bond yields went to, I think, to 15% at one stage, I think it was every 1% was €500 million in interest repayments was going to cost the Irish economy. So you can imagine the trillions that were in play in the US in this. And I think that was the final deciding issue when it came to people going to Donald Trump to say, listen, this is going to be a bridge too far. Mm-hmm. We cannot sustain this. And the nuclear event that was being called out was coming into play.
OK, it is squeaky bum time, though, isn't it, Louise? If big tech is now what Mara Sefcovic is going over with.
Absolutely. And I mean, that doesn't only impact us, and I think this is perhaps why we should look at it maybe and not be too concerned, because it's not just Ireland that this impacts. It impacts the whole of the European Union and impacts other European Union countries as well. None as much as it impacts us, but it does affect other countries. So it is, I mean, it is a real concern. And we have heard Donald Trump. We heard them on Tuesday evening giving that quite remarkable speech. I think it has to be said at a dinner. And he was saying, you know, I am coming for this. Pharma, I'm going to do that quite soon. So we have that. But he, it seems to be, for at least a short period of time, saying he's going to do
myself of what he said. Was that where he was speaking to an audience of Republican congressmen and he started doing impressions of them, asking him to pull back?
That was the one, and saying no one, you know, no one's a better negotiator than me, which, I mean, I think that's a questionable statement. But anyway, we'll see how Mara Sefcovic gets on over the weekend. And if he meets President Trump, it's probably very unlikely that he will actually get into Trump himself. But it's the tech stuff is very, very concerning, as is the pharmaceutical stuff. And that is also coming down the track. I was just out at a press conference, actually, in Clonsilla, and Public Expenditure Minister Jack Chambers was there. And he was also sounding the alarm about what's happening between the US and with China. And he was kind of saying that if they keep going back and forth, this tit for tat and these retaliatory tariffs, that in a open trading economy like ours, we are going to feel the impacts of that across not just Ireland but across the European Union. So it kind of feels like it's coming at us from all sides. And like George said, the 90-day pause, yes, it's welcome, but God only knows what could happen in those 90 days. Mm-hmm. What's Donald Trump going to do next? What impact can the European Union have, and what ears can they get to, and who can they speak to, and what can they say that might turn this around? Because it's very hard to know what's going to happen next.
And the reality is you can't bank on having 90 days, because he could change his mind tomorrow and say, actually, you know, I was just kidding and the markets went up again. I actually heard David McWilliam suggesting, and this I would not put past the man because I think he is the epitome of corruption, I have to say, that he possibly tipped off some of his pals about the fact that he was about to reverse the tariffs, so that when the markets...
But he said it publicly,
sunk,
didn't he?
He
good
was
time to
for
buy.
People to invest.
Yeah.
But he
alerted them to the fact that it was going to be reversed the next day.
He also pointed out, I think, when they were presenting the F1 drivers or the NASCAR drivers at the White House, that this guy had made, you know, 5 million, or this guy's made all 900 million. So obviously, it was part of his game as well, for him to be able to claim his usual this is a super day, it's a beautiful
day. Well, it made
rich people richer. Game. But you know, it would make you question, just thinking about Simon Harris's visit, Martin Hayden was over there as well. Is there any point in sending people over to talk to this administration?
Because all he's going to do is gloat.
I think there's every point in, you know, and particularly now, because what I do agree with what Brenda said there about, you know, the banking of the 90 days, maybe it will be longer. We hope that agreement could be found within 90 days. But ultimately, another thing has happened, and that is that formal trade negotiations are now taking place, which that wasn't happening prior to the announcement of the pause.
That's fine for Maris Sefcovic to go over, but I'm asking you whether it's a waste of our time to be sending people over there.
But I think
certainly not. Look, I mean, one of the things that I think it's really important to emphasise here, there's nothing wrong with the Irish government defending Ireland's interests in its bilateral negotiations with the United States and at the same time defending its interests within the European Union and working as a bloc. And I think we really do have to move beyond this narrative that somehow the EU are against Ireland and is it a blue jersey or a green jersey? And, you know, George there for the Labour Party was touching on that a little bit, which I was a bit surprised with, to be honest, because Sinn Féin have sort of done this line, are you blue, are you green? You know, and what he said there about criticising the Commission President, like, this is a moment of national unity. Whatever dispute we may have had with the President of the European Commission, right now we are way stronger together. 560 million people, 560 million consumers. We are a beacon for free
George,
trade
go
and rule of law.
Absolutely. And I'm not taking away from what James has said, but if big tech is part of this shake-up, then we are in serious bother. And the EU know the impact that any negotiations involving big tech and Ireland will have. So, I mean, you know, yes, of course.
And not everybody is on the same pages as here. I know Louise said that there are other countries who are concerned about taxing big tech, but France said it, first of all. Then
absolutely.
Germany said it, then Austria said it. So there are conflicting interests.
To put it bluntly, every single country in the European Union is concerned about the impact of any tariff. It's concerned about the impact of the investment volatility that is continuing because of the decisions the administration have taken. And, of course, their trade war that is ongoing between China.
But we're powerless as individual countries because we've handed over our competency for trade negotiations to the EU and Maris Sefcovic has to do the
that
job.
That has its merit as well because, like, you know, there's 450 million of a trading bloc, 1.6 trillion of trade.
But is there any point then in sending Simon Harris or Martin Hayden or anybody else over
there to
speak
to? I absolutely believe there is, and I agree with James that we should be there, we should be at the table, we should be talking to the people, particularly since what appears to be the intervention of Republican senators, you know, who appear to have gotten to Trump to say, listen, this is a bridge too far, you must pull back on this, you must change course. I think the Irish have to be there front and centre, particularly in the area of big tech. But you have to balance that also with the treatment of our own Taoiseach on St. Patrick's Day when Donald Trump said, sorry, I can't meet you. In comes Conor McGregor. I mean, that was the greatest slap in the face to any nation that we ever saw. But we have to be there at the negotiating table because I think at this stage, it is not just Trump we're dealing with. I think we're dealing with other players who may be a little bit more sensible.
But we still have to be mindful of his ego. And when you say, you know, should we send somebody? He does clearly relish having, as he put it, his ass kissed. And we have to go and do that. And if that's what it takes to get any kind of advantage with them or any kind of leverage whatsoever, then I'm afraid that's what we're going to have to do.
Mm-hmm. And let's be
let's
assess the situation. One thing I would agree with George here, they're not coming to the negotiations now from a very strong position of strength. I mean, the withdrawal of the tariffs has to have been directly related to the cost of borrowing that the United States were paying. So they're no longer coming at a position where you might have seen that he was domestically at the peak of his political power. He's been weakened quite a lot, significantly.
So you think Maris Sefcovic is going over there with the upper hand on Sunday?
I think right now, as matters stand, quite clearly the EU is coming with a greater position of strength because of the decision that the United States administration have taken to pause the tariffs versus introduce them immediately. And
but
this
then
is a
what
much better situation.
That is the unpredictability of the man at the administration. You know, it doesn't matter where he is or how many cards he's holding. He could do anything.
And there is no getting away from that. And we have to be truthful about that, acknowledge that. Everyone listening to this knows that there's a huge unpredictability that's very damaging for investment. But we have to control the controllables. And one of them is that there's a window open now. There's a possibility for negotiation. The Trade Commissioner's going over there. As I say, Simon Harris is already there. And those negotiations will hopefully continue, and in a really optimistic case scenario, will produce lower trade barriers between the United States and Europe to preserve that $1 trillion market.
I do think we have to think about, though, and like we're hoping for the best and Maros Sefcovic is going over. What happens if it all goes disastrously? What happens if it riles up the Trump administration? What happens if, like Brenda said, this 90 days, we can't bank on it? What if it suddenly becomes shorter? What if the EU tariff goes up? So I think rather than hoping for the best, I think we need to be planning for the worst. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that that is going on, but I think you have to look at it like a glass half full, glass half empty kind of situation, because we just don't know. And I think we're being overly optimistic.
Yeah, he could get a Zelensky style reception in the White House and the whole thing go pear shaped.
Yeah,
I mean the reality is you cannot bank on anything the man says, and that's a, you know, obviously uncertainty is the enemy of any sort of economic
I think he did say the EU have played this very smart. Now how long that sentence
I don't know if he meant that as a compliment.
That's not
though.
A compliment.
I don't think we can underestimate the influence of others around him now who appear to have somehow got a hold of him we saw the stock markets tanking, and 62% of the Americans deal in stocks and shares. That is obviously going to have a knock-on impact on everybody across the board. The bond market, of course. So there would appear to be others. I appreciate what you're saying, Brendan, in terms of we're dealing with an egotistical sociopath in reality. Whether he can on a daily basis take advices from others. But to my mind, his pulling back was a major pullback for him.
He doesn't. But he's not seeing it that way, and he's not spinning it that way. And you know, if you listen to analysis, the view is that he still surrounds himself with people who tell him what he wants to hear, and that if you don't, you're not in the room. So if you want to be in the room with him, you go in
I think something changed. Something changed in the past number of days. It was a huge change from Donald Trump, from his usual egotistical, this is a beautiful thing. He's still saying it, but his actions have transformed the declaration.
The dynamics are so interesting, because I was reading this morning that Steve Besant was one of the people who was instrumental in convincing him. And he came out onto the White House lawn with a big grin on his face, saying this was the plan all along.
Exactly.
He's a supreme negotiator. He said this was going to happen from the very beginning. And then we read all the back channeling.
It was the plan for Elon Musk to lose $200 billion.
Well, okay. I hear he made it back again.
You'll never know the truth there. You will never know if that was the plan all along or if this was the plan when things started to plummet. And you have to take all these things with a pinch of salt. We'll never know. It'd make a great movie one day, but
for now it's a horror film.
Yeah.
Awesome. let's move on, because we were talking earlier about the 40% drop in numbers seeking international protection here. That is being linked to a threefold increase in deportation orders issued so far this year. That's compared to the same period last year. So Louise, come to you first on this one. The new Justice Minister, Jim O'Callaghan, can he take the credit for tackling a tricky political issue and then claim that he's delivering results? Because Roderick O'Gorman said he's reaping the benefits of what they did in his term, or the last government did.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a fair assessment from Roderick. And I think for the last year, perhaps there's been kind of a tougher stance on immigration. And I mean, if you just think about the electoral cycle that we've just been through, we had the European and local elections in last June. And when I was going out canvassing, or when I was speaking to people who were out canvassing, they were saying that, you know, it's the big issue on the door. Everyone's speaking about it. And then when it came to the general election, when I was going out watching some of those politicians canvass, the same ones, they were saying it wasn't coming up nearly as much. So I think the previous government were acting on it, perhaps not quick enough. But I think there has, since Jim O'Callaghan became Justice Minister, there has been a marked difference in tone. He has been much tougher, I think it's fair to say, than Helen McEntee was. He's using much tougher words than Helen McEntee was at the time. But things that were put in place during the last administration have made a difference. Things like, you know, single male applicants not getting guaranteed accommodation when they come here and having to sleep in tents for a time on the canal and then tents in other places. That's going to act as a deterrent as well. And I think that was initially the plan, cutting the benefits. That was part of the plan to act as a deterrent. So I think in some ways Roderick is right. This is stuff that was done, or was at least started, in the last government. But I do think it's fair to say that Jim O'Callaghan has definitely come across and sounded stricter on this.
Talking tough, but not really acting in any substantively different way.
Not really. And I mean, if you look, even I heard people talking about the chartering of these flights, and, you know, there was people sent back to Georgia on a flight last month, and it was said that that was going to be the first, and this was, you know, it was a recommencement. But it was a recommencement because Helen McEntee had already said in the last government that this was going to be something that was done. So, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves, and I'm sure the government can come out and say, you know, not only have we had fewer people coming here, but we've also been sending more people back. But I mean, it doesn't negate the issue, and it doesn't negate the requirement that they need to get suitable accommodation for these people. They need to process their applications quickly, and they need to treat them humanely. And I think that's the bit they have to balance, that they're not balancing very well, because these people, some of who, yes, are coming here for economic reasons, other people are very, very vulnerable and are not being given, as we have heard and as the courts have said, are not being given the protection and the accommodation and the requirements that they should be given. So, you know, you can't just talk tough. You have to actually follow through on it, but you have to be humane at the same time. And I don't necessarily know if they're hitting all of those marks.
Do you have concerns, George, about that? That the system might be getting quicker and more efficient, more people sent back, but is it fair to those who are genuinely seeking protection here?
Well, I don't think the system as we have at the minute is in any way efficient. I mean, people need to be treated with dignity, fairness and humanity, just as we would like the Irish who travel the world to be treated, but also in a timely manner. One of the efficiencies that has happened is that it has been turned into a very, very lucrative business here in Ireland. And there are many people who have made serious amounts of money by the privatisation of the accommodation system of people who are seeking asylum.
But Roderick O'Gorman, his aim was to change that. And then we had the war in Ukraine and we had COVID, and that white paper got put on the back burner.
The notion that people are coming here for a number of years before a decision is made on their status is really causing a lot of angst. First of all, the people eventually, obviously, set down their roots here. Mm. Their children attend school here. They join the soccer club, the curling club.
Is that not exactly what's changing, though, with the asylum processing system?
Well, I'm not arguing with that. What I'm saying is it needs to be a much more efficient system.
But that's what I'm saying to you. Is the government not telling us now that the system is much more efficient?
Well, it doesn't appear to be. We're still, you know, I mean, and I would welcome a much more efficient, humane and fair system. I mean, but the notion that people who are coming from safe countries are here for a couple of years before a decision is made, to me, is ludicrous.
But they're not anymore. I mean, people coming from safe countries, and that is one of the reasons why there has been, I suppose, the speeding up in deportations or whatever.
But there has also been a reduction in people coming because of the message has been sent out. Because of the tents also.
Countries, but in fairness, under the previous administration, were identified as safe countries, and the safe country applicants are subject to an accelerated procedure. And so they're not going to be here for years anymore.
Yeah, well that is most welcome, because it doesn't benefit anybody. It certainly doesn't benefit the people who are. And, you know, we do have economic migrants, but we sent millions of people across the world as economic migrants. Mm-hmm. I think also we need to have a system where if we need workers, say in the construction industry, we can identify people, be they from a safe country like Georgia, for instance, where we can bring them in and benefit the economy of working in a system that is, you know,
well, is the worker permit system not working then? Is that not?
It doesn't appear for countries like Georgia. It doesn't appear to be. I mean, my daughter's a nurse in Sydney. The first time she worked a full shift with Irish nurses was in Sydney. Not in. She worked in Cork in hospital, in Wexford General Hospital around the time of the fire. First time she ever worked with a full cohort of Irish nurses on a shift was in Sydney.
And your point is, it works in health, but it's not working in other sectors.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Roderick O'Gorman made the point earlier that there's one line in the programme for government about accommodation, James, for asylum seekers. I mean, you can't just focus on the application system and sending people off. You have to solve both problems at the same time.
Well, I think it's important to step back for a moment, because obviously under the previous government, Roderick O'Gorman's role was solely to do with the housing of international applicants. It was separated from the Department of Justice, which made the decisions when a person arrives. That's now over. So that was a policy that the Green Party wanted in the last government that is now gone. Okay. So really, in terms of why is this happening now, and I think Brenda touched on some of it, it is the outworkings of what Helen McEntee did in the Department of Justice over the last number of years. And I can point to three things. One is the accelerated decision making. So there are, if I can just give you some quick figures here. So there's In 2019, there was 143 people working in the International Protection Office. In 2025, there's 613. And what that has resulted in is that the IPO delivered 14,000 decisions last year versus 8,500 decisions the previous year. And if you look at the tribunal, which is where people can appeal to, they closed around 3,000 appeals in 2024 compared to 1,700 in 2023. So like most major structural changes that happen in this country, it does take time, but it came from the investment that we made in the decision making for people who are arriving to this country so that we have a firm but a fair process. And you asked there about the general employment permits system. Is that working? That is working. I mean, we are issuing...
So Jim O'Callaghan, who was, look, fairly critical of Fine Gael justice ministers in the past, goes in there, takes the proposal. You're saying too he's reaping the rewards of what Fine Gael did in the past.
Well, what I'm saying is that the investments that Helen McEntee and the government made on the last occasion, and I should say that we also have, for the first time ever, a minister of state solely dedicated in the area of migration in Colin Brophy. What I'm saying
so
is...
So it's not fair of Jim O'Callaghan to claim that he's delivering dramatic results.
I don't know. I haven't heard Jim O'Callaghan saying it was Helen's or victory or it's my victory. I don't particularly care. I don't think the public particularly care. What they care about is that the process, the system, is functioning in the way it should be. And the reason it's functioning, and people can look up the statistics for themselves, is because of the investments that the government has made over the last number of years.
The accommodation issue for asylum seekers is off the table. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what has happened now is that instead of having this separate focus where we're essentially running around the country trying to find hotels to accommodate people coming to the country, the focus of the government is on the people who are arriving. Do they have a right to be here? And then we try and identify, do we have sufficient accommodation for those who do have a right to be here? And I should say, when he's talking about there's only one line in the programme for government, what the line refers to is about the state taking greater ownership, which speaks to George's point, which is that it is the case that in responding to the emergency that we had, that essentially a lot of the private sector has made a significant amount of money, and we want to move away from that. But
you're so slow to do it, though, because we had the Catherine Day report. I don't know how many years old it is now. I think it's 2021, I think it might have been, the report calling for those centres to be built by the state, and nothing has happened.
Yeah, but let's be truthful. The Catherine Day report was effectively ripped up the moment the Ukrainian war took place, the moment the increase in the number of international applicants who come to this country increased.
No one from the government said it was ripped up. Everyone said it was still on the table. And then there was she went back and she looked at it again, in fact, increased the number of centres that she believed that we should have. That's never been said before.
I think everybody and the general public know full well that it was not the case that the state could suddenly produce a sufficient amount of state-owned housing to accommodate, let's say, the 100,000 Ukrainian refugees who are coming here or the additional international applicants who are coming here. The principle in the Catherine Day report is something that is supported, which is that we need to move away from the private ownership structure towards a state-owned
structure.
Like, and that is what the government are going to do.
It's worth saying as well, how many times did Roger Cormann and the last government go and bang on the table and say, I need help from the other departments. Come to me with what buildings you have. He was essentially shafted by the Department of Housing, who weren't stepping in to help at all. He was constantly asking for help. The idea was constantly to move away from the hotels because we saw the issues that caused in some local communities. And when he was asking for help and he was asking for buildings, they were not forthcoming and he didn't get them. So, I mean, I think it's unfair of James to say that, you know, the whole Roger Gorman's whole focus was on housing asylum seekers. He was asking for help and he didn't get it. So, of course,
But in fairness, you did point out the canals and adult males sleeping in tents. That's in my constituency. And that was an awful situation. Which was a health disaster, which was remedied. So it isn't the case any longer.
By putting them in tents in other places?
Well, that's not actually truthful. I mean, in that area beside the IPO centre on Mount Street, which, as I say, is in my constituency, very familiar with, on one of the days when it was at the peak, those tents were going right up to the National Maternity Hospital. Okay, so that isn't the case because we did find additional suitable accommodation to ensure, and also we changed the processing so that the processing was being done at the location where people arrived for families and for women. In my own constituency, new centres were opened during that period between the local elections and the general election. And one of the reasons it wasn't coming up on the doors as much was actually because a lot of the tents that previously were there were no longer there. I think there was a sense that the state had taken back control somewhat. And that's, I suppose, reflected in the figures that we've seen today.
And George, is it off the agenda for constituents?
No, no. All the while, this is playing into the hands. This is system failure is playing into the hands. It was only this morning we heard about the reduction in numbers. All the while, it's playing into the hands of the far right. You know,
Didn't hear about it as much in polling, certainly around the election, and I think subsequently as well, as we did around the time of the, as Louise said, the local elections and Europeans.
There is this undercurrent that's been driven by the far right that it's still keeping it on the agenda. And as I say, even in Wexford now, there are still people looking to make huge sums of money through the government by the housing of
as people. They're entitled to do, because that's the way the system is currently set up.
Well, that's because it's been turned into a business, because the plans that were put in place haven't been implemented.
Okay, listen, we have to leave it there, but thank you all for coming in. James Gagan from Fine Gael, George Lawler from Labour, Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror, and Brenda Power, journalist and commentator.